Okay, good morning. Tuesday, January 14th, 2025. And we're going to start with a period of meditation, followed by speaking. Although I will be speaking through some of the meditation as well, so just all right. So just settling into a posture that supports you becoming more calm and more clear-minded. Quite interesting that just closing our eyes and coming into stillness can change our mind and body states. Just feeling your body at rest and seeing if just that alone can help you to release tension. Just have a sense of letting go. It's one of the little miracles of mindfulness that when we actually feel the tension that we hold in our bodies, can often let go of much of it. And then letting the breath come to the foreground of your attention. Not so much that we're trying to create a special mind state, more that we allow calm and focus to be revealed when we let go of stress and tension, grasping. Well, we can point the attention at the breath, at the sensations, either at the nostrils or the belly. That's the aspect of meditation we call cultivating or arousing. Cultivating the attention, arousing the attention. But the other side is the letting go. And this may be more important, certainly equally important. So starting by letting go of physical tension as best you can, even while maintaining an upright, balanced posture, aligned. along with letting go of tension in the body. Let go of the threads of thought. Again, as best we can, we may find ourselves involved in a lengthy thought and realize, oh, I've been thinking for a while. That's fine. But whatever moment you realize that you're drifting in that way, you can come back. And this isn't a rejection of thought or a suppression of thought. Really more of a turning away from the thought, not a pushing away, not a rejection. Just turning toward breath, toward the body, toward ease. And see if you can be aware or attuned to the energetic quality behind thoughts, behind feelings. So we talk about grasping or desire and aversion. And these have mental components. There are thoughts associated with them. But perhaps the more vital aspect is the energetic one, the feeling of a pull or a push. And this is felt in the body, but also in a kind of energetic way that isn't quite in the body. It's really like the crossroads of mind and body. That the energy is more generated by the mind, but experienced more in the body. And as we become more mindful of our experience, we're able to attune to these subtle energies and see how much they influence the whole perception of our lives, how we interpret what's going on. We build stories and identity out of these simple energies. If this kind of focus gets too complicated or confusing, just keep it simple. Return to the breath, in, out. Well, welcome again. This month is time when a lot of people get sober or return to recovery. And so if you are in that cohort, welcome. Good time to reestablish that commitment. As I said, I guess I set it off the recording, but I'm got a lingering cold and cough, and not at the sharpest mental state. Excuse me, God. So, what to talk about? A couple of things. One of the things I've mentioned lately is how, on Tuesdays, the New York Times has its science section, and there's almost invariably something in there, often multiple stories in there. There were several in there that were relevant to our themes, certainly to the addiction theme. The one was about the problem of middle-aged drinking and how that's getting worse, apparently. More middle-aged people. I wouldn't know, not being middle-aged, but the story that kind of got me going is something I've been talking about in my household lately, because there have been a few articles about research into ultra-processed food, and if you think that's not an issue of addiction, think again. What's striking, well, first of all, just ultra-processed food is just stuff we sort of know what it is, right? So it got all this junk in it, and emulsifiers and chemicals that you don't know what they are, and don't even know how to pronounce them when you read the ingredients. That's pretty much a sign that it's ultra processed. But what struck me in this article was that, well, first of all, 60 something like 60% of American diet is ultra processed food. So we wonder why we have a obesity epidemic. But then the very striking thing was that ultra-processed food became particularly widespread when the tobacco companies started buying food companies in the 80s. It's like, great, who would we trust to bring health to America, and so I just found that ironic. Gee, we've killed enough people. They're not buying this deadly product. Let's create a new one. And of course, another addictive product, the tobacco and UPFs, as those in the know call them. I'm sure those of a certain age here remember the old Lay's commercial, "Bet you can't eat just one," right? And so what was that about? Well, bet you can't drink just one, right? So that was the mantra of the alcoholic. But sorry, now you got to hear my cough. I'm gonna mute it. So, I mean, it's just, not that I want to talk about, food addiction, which we kind of all have a little bit of, but rather that, the way, desire and craving, and how it's something that's, part of being a human being, a natural thing, a requirement for survival. If you don't have any desire, you're not gonna live. Unless you're enlightened, I guess. You'll have to ask those people wherever they are. But it's just interesting how, when you talk about greed or the desire for accumulation, And then the desire for pleasure, just other different form, how one person's desire, greed, feeds another person's desire for pleasure. You know, a corporation wanting to make a lot of money figures out a way to get people addicted to their product. And you know, it's one of the tragedies of human civilization that we don't try to create a society that's beneficial to everyone. And I mean, you know, I guess even talking about such a thing is naive, maybe certainly idealistic. But, you know, for at least for people, Buddhist practitioners, and I would say, you know, anybody with authentic spiritual beliefs and principles that they live by, it makes sense to develop a society that's for the benefit of all the people in the society. That's the in fact the logical thing to do, not just the spiritual thing to do, to benefit everyone. But obviously, human craving and fear, and as well as aversion, hatred, bias, bigotry, all you know, move people in other directions. So here in you know in our in the recovery world, I'll say here, if I'm talking about here, where I'm talking about this world of people in recovery, we find we have to approach this in an individual way because society isn't supporting us necessarily. And then so we create these communities like this where we support each other in trying to live a wholesome way. And you know, that's the beautiful thing that we have. We have this capacity, like, okay, there's these corporations and, you know, organizations and things that are pushing in one direction, but we don't all have to get on that particular bandwagon. We can create our own way of living, and I think that the community, this community, for what, just one example, is vital to this process because to be left alone in this world of greed, hatred, and delusion, and try to, you know, find your own way of living in a fulfilling life that's wholesome and guided by, you know, kindness, compassion, wisdom. Very difficult to do that alone, and lonely to do that alone, and, you know, alienating. So this is, you know, really, really precious to me. I you know, my life is really oriented around this community, around people who are living in this way. And, you know, my own household, you know, is oriented in this way. Not just sobriety itself, because my daughter drinks. She's staying with us right now, but she doesn't drink in an unwholesome way. But I know her values are aligned with the ones that I think we represent here. And certainly my wife, my partner, also has really beautiful values. And so just to me, you know, my teaching is as much for myself to have a community as it is for others. When I wrote One Breath at a Time, it was like a call out to the world to say, are you there? It was reaching out. I mean, I knew, I believed you were there. I believed that this really worldwide culture of recovery and Dharma existed or was a potential. But I really, besides the other purposes in writing that, part of it was to find and for us to be able to be together and form a community, because it certainly in early recovery, I felt like a person alone, bridging two worlds. I got sober in LA and in the West Side up Venice Beach, and that's a pretty, a lot of countercultural folks in the area, artists and the like, and so I did find people who were interested in what I was interested in, but I didn't find anyone who was doing what I was doing. There was nobody in that community, that recovery community, that was involved in Buddhism, and there was nobody in the Buddhist community that was in recovery or was interested in recovery or saw it as, saw the 12 steps as something, relevant to them. So it really was, I mean, it was okay, I got through it. I had what I needed. I had those two separate communities, but over time, I did start to sort of foster little connections here and there. And with a group of men, we started a meditation, group, a meditation 12-step group, which there weren't any that did even 20 minutes of meditation. There was one that I've taught, often refer to this, the one that would do 5 minutes of meditation, and then everybody would spend the next hour and a half talking about how difficult that was to meditate for 5 minutes. And I had been on a 3-month retreat, and I would just sit there going, "You guys really don't have a clue, do you? Wow, what am I going to do about you people?" Yeah, it took me some almost 20 years to do anything about it. Actually, when I moved to the Bay Area, I started to find some people who were particularly interested in, and a couple of young people that I met at Cal, which is, for those who don't know, that's the University of California at Berkeley, also known as Berkeley. But I was 41, a 41-year-old junior, but I started going to AA, and I met some. They had AA campus meetings on campus, and a couple of the people in one of the meetings really was interested in what I was talking about, and I took them with me on a retreat, and kind of turned them into Buddhists. But yeah, I mean, and that was when, as I've sort of talked a little bit about in my books, when I, at 6 or 7 years sober, that I started to actually try to formulate something that was a connection between the two, because I had actually kept the two things, Buddhism and the 12 steps, separate in my mind and in my behavior. And that was partly because I was kind of afraid that if I tried to bring them together, I actually was afraid that the Buddhism would corrupt the 12-step side of it, which might sound odd, but I had been into Buddhism before I got sober, so I knew that meditating was not a program. Sorry, I'm gonna mute a little bit so I can. Well, anyway, so yeah, I had this kind of feeling like, oh, I don't know, just to be a Buddhist, being a Buddhist, that's not going to do it. Like, I really needed this AA thing. I really needed these 12 steps. But I also felt like, it's 12 steps. How the heck are they going to fit with Buddhism? There's no all this God stuff and inventories and powerlessness. I don't know. I need to do this. I need to do both. I need to go on my retreats and meditate every day, read my Dharma, and I need to go to meetings and work with my sponsor. It just was like, as it is for us, right? It's just what we do because we have to. Like, it wasn't like a choice. Like, okay, I need this, I don't know how it's going to work. But yeah, then I finally started to think about, well, is there a way that these can speak to each other? And, that's like, it was another decade really before that got formulated into, started to form into a book. But as I say, there was this always this kind of feeling of like not having a home, not having a true spiritual home. I had these two separate homes which were lovely, but I'd go to an AA meeting and I didn't feel like I could, I obviously couldn't really talk about the Dharma, and I'd go to a meditation retreat and like people didn't really want to hear, oh yeah, I'm an alcoholic. It's like, well, no, that's, you're not supposed to be an alcoholic, you're supposed to be a Buddhist, So it was, I didn't, so it was after I started the first day. So again, maybe a little story I haven't told before. The first day of the teacher training that I went into in 1997 with Spirit Rock, it's called Community Dharma Leader Training. And we were at a, I think, a Dominican retreat center in San Rafael. And I was taking a walk during a break, and I encountered one of the other people on the retreat who I did not know. She was from New York, Sandra W. And we started talking and immediately realized we were both sober. And so it was like that the first day of my teacher training was like, because we kind of looked at each other like, oh, yeah, good. And, maybe we can do something with that, or maybe, because it was in my mind by then, well, if I'm all along, I had thought, well, these people in AA need meditation. Maybe someday I can teach them meditation. And then it's like, wow, I've been invited into a teacher training program. Okay. Yeah, maybe I'll be able to do that. And I didn't know what that was going to look like or in what context I'd offer it. But, these little seeds were being planted, and yeah, it just evolved out of that. But coming back to what I kind of started to say, it was as much about finding my own community as it was about, being a guru for the people in recovery. I mean, sure, there's always that thing in your mind, like, oh yeah, I'm gonna do this thing, like I'm gonna be this rock star, Dharma teacher, blah blah, But it was a pretty insignificant part of the motivation. It was really this need to not be alone. And that's been really that, when I go for periods of time, occasionally it'd be like a little bit of time when I don't teach, I start to feel adrift. And this Tuesday class has helped me so much over these years. And every time I teach, there's always a part of me that's like, oh, do I have to do this? Because it's work, right? It's my job. And then I'm like, I get, oh, it's like, oh, I always, my wife always reminds me, you always feel better after you teach, you know? Oh, yeah, thanks. Yeah, so I shouldn't cancel. Yeah. Speaking of which, you know, my trip to San Diego, I don't know. There you go. So I don't know. That's just what came up today is you know, a little bit of that story, but you know, I'm not telling the story so much for the entertainment value, but really to point to that we all need this community. And I hear it so often from people that when they discover Buddhist recovery, there this relief they have and this sense of being home, and being able to be wholly themselves. I mean, I've often pointed out the irony that, you know, the Four Noble Truths start with the truth of suffering, but in Buddhist circles, people don't often talk about their personal suffering. And it's kind of like they feel that, oh, I'm not supposed to, I'm, you know, that's, there's no self, so I shouldn't be talking about my own pain or whatever. And, or we talk about it in these very abstract ways and, you know, distant ways that not the way we do in a meeting. And I found that know, opportunity to really speak the truth about individual personal suffering to be really a vital part of sustaining recovery. So I think that's maybe enough there. If anybody wants to chime in and share, I'm just glancing back at the chat there. You are welcome to raise your virtual hand or just unmute yourself and speak. Anne Peruzzi Bulger. Or
Hi.
is it Bulger
It's
Peruzzi?
Bulger Peruzzi.
Okay, nobody knows, but
I love
okay.
how you just like with my name, it's really funny, Kevin.
What?
It's very funny with me. Anyway,
Yeah.
we'll talk about it later.
Okay, later.
It's charming. So many things you said. You know, of course, I thought about the jewel of Sangha. You know. The jewel of this beautiful opportunity we do have to get together and talk about our suffering. And you know, in AA, it's like, you know, we talk about like not even in AA though, there's boundaries. It's like don't get into a drunkalogue, focus on the solution, you know. Which is great. But I don't know. I think you provide an opportunity. Well, I think the Dharma provides an opportunity to be able to, you know, share about our suffering, our dis-ease, but really learn ways to not ultimately not identify with it. Like, I'm sorry you're sick. I'm really, my heart goes out to you. I'm coughing. It hurts. I know. Yeah, so that's all. That's just kind of what that I'm really learning deeply ways to let go, to soften into the words you use, the pushing and the pulling. Like just okay. Notice what's the mind, the pushing and the pulling just soften. Doesn't have to let go of anything. soften the grip, like open the grip.
Yeah.
And so yeah. And just the longing to belong, you know, not wanting to be alone. That was beautiful. Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks, Anne.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't want to suggest that focusing on the solution is not a good idea. That's definitely not just here to complain, but I don't know. It was for me, it was really important to be able to speak the truth of my pain and confusion and delusion. And yeah, I mean that's what's beautiful about the Four Noble Truths characterize the problem, its cause, the potential to end it, and the pathway to end it. And certainly the Eightfold Path is the ultimate solution from a Buddhist viewpoint. And that's what we're here to cultivate. Yeah. But again, like you can't have a solution if you don't know what the problem is. And I think for a lot of us, when before we got sober, we didn't know what the problem was. I know for me, I didn't know what the problem was, or you're in denial about what the problem is. So either way, you're not addressing the problem. So that's why the honesty about the problem and the pain is so important before we can transition into solving. Tanya, hi.
Hi, Kevin. Hi, Sangha. So, as you know, Kevin, about 16 years ago, my mentor and sponsee, Al C, started a group called One Breath at a Time at the Atlanta Shambhala Meditation Center. And I had not met Al yet, but I remember hearing about that meeting. I thought, one breath at a time, that sounds very interesting, you know? So I went, met him. He ended up becoming my sponsor eventually, and also my mentor. So he had a really similar experience as you, Kevin. He was already a Buddhist, practicing Buddhist, involved with Shambhala, and also still drinking. And so, you know, when he got sober, he realized there needed to be a connection there. So he found your book. And the whole meeting is based on your book, One Breath at a Time. And so for the first few years, we only read One Breath at a Time over and over. And then eventually we threw in mindfulness in the 12 steps and I think 12 steps on Buddha's path. That's Therese Jacob Stewart and Laura S., if you're not familiar with them. And there have been a couple others, but we basically rotate through two or three books now. And of course, One Breath at a Time is one of them. But what I wanted to really mention is the happiness and excitement that I saw on my sponsor's face when he was telling me about it was just. It blew his mind to find your book. You know, it was just, he was so happy to have it. He was so happy to be able to share it. And he felt the same way. Are people going to really be into it? I would say half the people who come to our meeting are either Buddhist or somewhat casual practitioners. I consider myself a fairly casual practitioner. And then the other half are people who are just need an AA meeting, you know, but they have interest in it. You know, when we start talking about the things in the book, they are, you know, they get it. So it's just really amazing. And I just want to thank you again for having the courage to write that book and wait for us to come to you.
Thanks, Tanya. Sweet. John, hello.
Hey, Kevin, can you hear me okay?
Yep, hear
Oh,
you
good.
fine. Yeah.
Not sure if these headphone mics work well, but just a quick community story, and I appreciate the topic, and I hope you feel better soon too. That feeling, I got diagnosed with walking pneumonia a few weeks ago, and it seems to be spreading rapidly. But so, quick story. I used to live in Walnut Creek about 15, 16, 17 years ago, and went to meetings regularly and moved away, moved to the city for a few years, and then moved to North Carolina. In the course of attending your classes, I think I've been doing it for maybe a year, somebody that I used to go to meetings with in Walnut Creek 15 years ago has been attending your meetings for a number of years, and so reached out to me. I'm going to maintain his anonymity, but I just wanted to say that it's one of those small miracles of community, either in AA or, Buddhism. It's just it's an incredible, incredible thing. So thanks for being here.
Thanks, John. Sweet. Yeah, eventually they all come over to our side, once they see the light. Jeff, hi. You're still muted.
I am that guy. It was a great treat to see John Manlove on your video cast. And nice to know that he's still sober. He was a lot of trouble back in the day. I want to talk for a moment about suffering. There is a I have been thinking lately, and that there is a purpose to the suffering that we encounter. Our personal suffering helps us to understand the suffering that exists everywhere and in every individual. There used to be an AA thing: you spot it, you got it. If you feel like, oh, that person's all messed up, that's because there's something messed up in you. If you feel that that person is delightful, that's because there's something delightful in you. I've been in constant contact with a group of people that I know in the Los Angeles area, some affected by the fire, some not. But I've been reduced to tears several times by the stories that they have told me. And I think it is a wonderful thing that their suffering and my suffering are just the suffering. We all get a piece of it. Some get a big slice, some get a little slice. I'm going through some difficulty with mobility. And as I walked across the street this morning and nearly fell down because the legs not doing what legs are supposed to do, I thought, God, how lucky I am to have not fallen down. That's, I don't know. Don't want to get too airy fairy philosophical, but maybe that's the best we can do, is not fall down. And this, the whole Buddhist recovery thing, I would not still be sober if I had not found this path. So I too thank you.
Thanks, Jeff. Yep, not falling over. That's a good ambition. I've been working on that myself. So we have reached 11 o'clock, which means that officially we are at the close. I will I have arranged my travel so that I will be able to be on here on Zoom from San Diego next Tuesday, assuming that I don't decide in the next 2 days that flying to San Diego is not really on the agenda. So everything is unknown, unstable. So appreciate people showing up. Seems that this group has actually grown a bit in the past couple months, which is somewhat surprising to me. Expected to keep getting smaller, but anyway. I will keep doing this as long as I can, which no reason to think it won't be for a long time. But yeah, and I was talking to my wife last night, like we were talking about plans we have for next summer, and I was like, "Do you think I'll be over this cold by then?" And it was good for me to like, oh yeah, right. Like, yeah, this could last a while, but it probably won't last till this summer. So sometimes you got to use impermanence as like, okay, eventually this will end. I don't know when, but probably before the summer. So, but I mean, I'm okay, again, appreciate people showing up and just being part of this little gathering. And we'll see you next Tuesday, if not before.
Thank you, Kevin.
Yeah,
Feeling
and
better.
thank you. And Vicky, I'm certainly okay with hanging out. So
Oh,
Vicky and I have a date for after
nice.
this. So, but I am going to take a bio break, and I'm going to leave Zoom on here and say goodbye to everybody.
Hey,
take care of
Kevin.
yourself, Kevin. Feel better.
Thanks.
Yep, feel better.
Bye, Kevin.
I would love to just